Hello and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Monday, July 27th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. Story on the front page, Educators Brace for Anxiety. This is written by Allie Hinga. Kate Borman expects to see the usual excitement from students as they come back to school next month. However, that will be mixed with some anxiety around returning to school after months away in the midst of a pandemic, said Borman, a school counselor at Our Lady of Guadalupe Spanish Immersion Program in Dubuque. I think it's going to have this layer of unknown and the fear of what is school going to be like and what is it going to look like and how different is it going to be is going to cause some anxiety from kids, parents, and teachers, Borman said. Local school officials say they are anticipating their students will have mental health, social, and emotional needs when they return to school in the coming weeks, connected to the various impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. Officials say that as students come back to the classroom, they are taking steps to make sure students feel safe and to address the needs as they arise. We need to attend to the social, emotional well-being of our staff and our kids first, before we look at the other things, said Tammy Cooley, Director of Student Services for the Potosi, Wisconsin School District. Dubuque Community School staffers have known since this spring that they will need to address emotional and behavioral health needs when students come back to school this fall, said Mimi Holsinger, the district's Director of Behavior and Learning Supports. For some students, schools are a safety net for providing access to mental health services, food, and other needs, along with positive adult relationships. I think we're a sense of hope for kids, Holsinger said. Community stress brought on by the pandemic in the form of job insecurity, lost wages, sickness, and death could bring out more mental health and emotional needs in students, she said. Families also seem to have concerns about their children's mental health. Of about 3,300 parents and guardians who responded to a district survey this summer, 38% said they were sometimes worried about their children's mental health and well-being because of the pandemic. Another 18% were concerned very often or all of the time, and 21% said they were concerned, but not very often. It was very eye-opening that three-fourths of our family said, to some degree, they were concerned with their kids' mental health and well-being because of COVID-19, Holsinger said. The return to school also might be a source of anxiety for some students, Borman said. They might fear encountering COVID-19 and the fact that their school year will look different. The need to social distance, even as they are with friends, will be hard for some students as well, she said. Max Long, Director of Student Services for the Platteville, Wisconsin School District, said he expects students' needs when they return to vary broadly, depending upon the experience during the pandemic. Some students have more stable home lives and thus less trauma as a result of the months-long school closure this spring. Others might have dealt with more challenging situations. Staff will need to respond to students' needs individually, Long said, and officials are working to educate staff in trauma-informed care to help guide their response. One key to helping students come back to school this fall will be to help them establish routines so they feel safe at school, even if those routines look different than they did before, Holsinger said. Staff also will be particularly intentional about developing relationships with students and letting them know how they can connect with the school counselor or other services. By getting students back to learning, staff can help provide them hope that they can move forward during the pandemic. The return to school also hopefully will provide students with some normalcy, Holsinger said, noting that the cancellations of so many of their normal activities can make kids feel stuck. I think they're really going to welcome the chance to even get back half-time, Holsinger said, referring to the hybrid learning model being used to start the school year. Cooley said Potosi educators have put a focus on social and emotional learning in recent years, so staff will continue to do so, but with some modification based on social distancing needs. For example, Classrooms typically have spaces in them for students to take a break if they need it. Instead, teachers might have to talk to students about activities they can do at their desk, such as mindful breathing. I think the thing that maybe we need to do is be more intentional with some of the safety measures we have to put in place, Cooley said. T.J. Potts, superintendent of the East Dubuque, Illinois School District, said staff will provide families with opportunities to talk about worries or concerns, and teachers will talk during their in-service week about recognizing signs of anxiety in students. When students return, staff will talk with them about steps they are taking to keep them safe. I think kids being out of school for so long, what do you look for? Potts said, you look for that trepidation, but also you look for those moments where you can really teach, and from the jump, you have to be teaching about social distancing. Another school-related story on the front page, survey, school supply sales could set record. This is written by Kaylee Reese of Telegraph Herald Media. As the start to the school year comes closer, national survey shows families anticipate spending a record amount on school supplies, exceeding the $100 billion mark for the first time. The survey, released July 15th by the National Retail Federation and Prosper Insights and Analytics, indicates the increase in spending stems from the anticipation of both in-person and virtual learning options. The projected total for spending is $101.6 billion, exceeding last year's total of $80.7 billion. Families with students in elementary through high school plan to spend an average of $789.49 this year, while families with college students anticipate spending $1,059.20. In part, the spending bump stems from families expecting to spend more on technology in preparation for virtual learning. Of survey respondents, 63% of families with K-12 students anticipate spending an average of $274.44 on electronics alone. David Perry, assistant manager at Dubuque's Best Buy, said the store is starting to see many high school and college students coming in for laptops with associated items. We're starting to see different plans to reopen, so laptops are in demand quite a bit more, he said. He added that Chromebooks are popular with students in middle school and below. There also has been more interest in laptop accessories like wireless headphones and cameras, Perry said, which make it easier to tune out the world and focus in on a class. In Iowa, Governor Kim Reynolds announced that students must spend at least half of their time in school, meaning all Iowa students will need supplies for in-person classes. In Dubuque, students are preparing for a hybrid model of in-person and virtual learning. Many families still haven't completed their school shopping. Only 17% of consumers reported completing their school shopping by early July. Charlie Hartig, CEO of Dubuque-based Hartig Drug, said he feels school shopping is currently a little slower than normal, but that may come from families waiting to hear final decisions on things from schools. Survey data also shows that 54% of shoppers who hadn't started looking for school supplies said they were waiting to see what all would be needed. In the meantime, Hartig said all Hartig stores are keeping stock of both basic back-to-school items and those unique to this year's list, including children's masks for students going back to school buildings. Our first initial orders have sold through, so we're ordering those daily, Hartig said. He said he also suspects many families will buy must-need supplies in smaller amounts to start the year before buying a larger amount in September after school schedules get settled. We want to be flexible and attentive to customer needs as they come up, Hartig said. Families are also planning to do more online shopping, with 55% of K-12 shoppers on the survey reporting plans to increase online spending. Representatives from both Walmart and Kohl's highlighted their pickup and delivery services for online school shoppers, as well as designated pages on their websites especially for school supplies and new clothes for the school year. The survey said that even among families preparing for virtual learning, back-to-school clothing sales at places like Kohl's or local stores is only slightly down from last year, from $239.82 to $234.48. Marissa Hoffman, owner and founder of The Midwest Girl, said the store now has more room to expand its youth section, including clothes geared toward students returning to school. The store moved to a larger location in the Millwork District in early June. While some students might have more of a uniform to follow, Hoffman said many young women love the trendy graphic t-shirts. The Midwest Girl also has seen online sales go up over the past several weeks, something that won't likely stop before the school year starts. "We've always had a website, but it's never been like this," Hoffman said. The article is accompanied by a photograph taken by Dave Kettering of people shopping at Best Buy on Sunday in Dubuque as the school year approaches. The photo is an inside picture of Best Buy with a shopper standing next to a student deals sign. And also on the front page, we have a BizBuzz story. And it's noted that BizBuzz stories share business tidbits from around the tri-state area. And this week, the Telegraph Herald will highlight developments in Dyersville, Iowa, Boscobel, Wisconsin, and Galena, Illinois. So the story today is renovations nearly done at Chad's Pizza, and this is reported by Jeff Montgomery. A lengthy effort to renovate a longtime Dyersville pizza restaurant is nearly complete. Chad's Pizza and Restaurant on First Avenue West has been under construction since late February. The workforce forced the beloved eatery to scale back services and, for one prolonged stretch, close its doors completely. Owner Chad Klaus said work will be wrapped up by mid-August. After years of success, it had become clear that such a project was necessary. "We were having some growing pains," he said. "We outgrew our kitchen, our storage, and our refrigeration space. This was something that had to be done." The pizzeria dates back to 1978 when it was opened under the name Leroy's Pizza and Restaurant. Klaus and his wife, Amy, became owners in 2004 and changed the name to Chad's Pizza and Restaurant. Klaus said the eatery has seen steady growth in its dining business in recent years. It also began wholesaling its products in 2019, reinforcing the need for additional space. Construction forced Chad's to close its doors entirely for a 10-week stretch beginning in mid-March. The business later reopened for carryout and delivery services, but the dining room has remained closed. When the revamped dining room opens in a few weeks, customers will be able to enjoy a space with a variety of new seating and decor. "It'll be fun for customers to come back and see it," Klaus said. "I think I'll see a few jaws dropping." As part of the renovation, crews moved the kitchen from the front of the building to the back. The owners modernized kitchen equipment and purchased a second pizza oven, which will double production capabilities. Chad's Pizza is currently open for pickup and delivery from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. and 4:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. Tuesday through Sunday. The business can be reached at 563-875-2483. And then another part of the story, new era for Boscobel business. "In many ways, Will Connolly felt uniquely prepared to take the reins at a popular Boscobel business. Connolly has been working part-time at Boscobel Bowl and Banquet for the past 13 years, learning about the business and establishing a rapport with many customers. But he admitted that owning the place has been a bit of an adjustment. It is more gratifying and it's a lot more work," he said with a laugh. "Being an owner is definitely a 7 days a week, 24 hours a day type of thing. Connolly took ownership on July 1st, making a new chapter for a business that had been owned by siblings Stacy Karsten and Jan Richter for the past 26 years. Karsten is confident that he is putting the operation in capable hands. "It really helps that Connolly has worked here," he said. "He knows the ins and outs of the business." While he isn't trying to reinvent the business, Connolly has sought to enhance the customer experience by expanding the hours and the menu. Previously open just 4 days per week during the summer, the business is now open every day. Connolly is also adding some flair to the existing menu by adding daily specials and placing a heavy emphasis on smoked meats. He has previously worked multiple jobs in the restaurant industry and is taking a hands-on approach as a business owner. "I am in the kitchen almost every night," he said. Boscobel Bowl and Banquet opens at 11 a.m. Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, and opens at 5 p.m. Tuesday through Friday. The business said closing time varies based on business levels. The business stays open until at least 8 p.m. Sunday through Thursday, and at least 9 p.m. on Fridays and Saturdays. The business can be reached at 608-375-2200. Another part of this report, new amenities at resort. A local resort recently unveiled a new and improved clubhouse with enhanced amenities and impressive views. Officials at Eagle Ridge Resort and Spa in the Galena Territory opened Highlands Restaurant and Lounge 289 last month, according to Director of Sales and Marketing Colin Sanderson. The restaurant and lounge serves a wide selection of locally produced beers, spirits, and foods. They connect to an expanded outdoor deck that offers views of the resort's most famous golf course, The General. Sanderson noted that the lounge space features four glass garage doors that can be opened on nice spring, summer, and fall days. He said, "We've always been known as a premier golf destination. What we were lacking was the premier clubhouse and restaurant to go along with it." The drinking and dining upgrades were part of a broader renovation of the clubhouse. Crews have also completed a new pro shop on the facility's lower level. It is three times larger than the old shop, providing ample space for golfers to check in and peruse the retail area. Officials also plan to relocate a general store and gas station to the clubhouse by mid-August, Sanderson said. Eagle Ridge Resort and Spa can be reached at 815-777-5000. The article is accompanied by a large front page picture of Chad's pizza owner, Chad Klaus, checking a large pizza at his new pizza oven. He's wearing a green t-shirt with Chad's pizza logo on it. And there's another picture of a hallway that is part of the renovation of, it's not a hallway, it's basically the renovation of the restaurant as supplies are continuing to be assembled. And there's also a picture of Jeff Montgomery, who was the senior reporter for the Telegraph Herald and the writer of this story. On the opinion page, we have an other view column. Felon voting rights needs permanent solution in Iowa. And it's written by the Reverend Neil P. Harrison of Maquoketa, Iowa, and there is a picture of Reverend Harrison at the head of the column. Did you know that Iowa is the only remaining state in the nation to deny voting rights to felons for life? This state is the only state that bars felons from voting unless the governor approves a voting rights application. A permanent solution is long overdue and is needed now. While Governor Kim Reynolds is to be commended for her commitment to sign an executive order this summer or early fall, and for her ongoing efforts to restore voting rights to felons who have completed their sentences and have been paroled, we need a more permanent solution. Last year and this year, she asked the legislature to put a constitutional amendment before voters that would automatically restore voting rights. The legislature adjourned last month and again failed to approve this measure. Executive orders are not permanent solutions and have created confusion. Governor Tom Vilsack restored the voting rights to 50,000 felons by executive order in 2005. Then, in 2011, Governor Kerry Branstad reversed the action in a dueling executive order. As Governor Reynolds said recently, quote, "I think it doesn't matter who's sitting in the governor's chair," unquote. A permanent solution is needed. Ex-felons deserve a second chance. They have paid their debt to society. The goals of corrections are for people to be reformed, rehabilitated, and successfully re-enter society. Allowing ex-felons to vote would help in their reintroduction into society. Voting fosters respect for the law and participating in the common good. Current policies also impose punitive long-term sanctions must be reformed for the sake of successful reentry and the reduction of recidivism. Restrictions, including the denial of the right to vote, restricted access to public housing and eligibility for public assistance or educational loans, and barriers to employment for the entire lives due both to employers' increased access to criminal records and exclusion from occupations harms ex-felons personally and financially. These restrictions are counterproductive and often lead to reincarceration. We need to increase the possibility of successful reentry to society. The main responsibility lies, finally, with the offender, but impediments to successful reentry need to be removed to the greatest extent possible. Furthermore, denying voting rights to ex-felons for life contributes to the racial divide polarizing our nation. Almost 8% of black adults, more than 2 million Americans, are prevented from voting because of felony convictions, compared to just under 2% of non-African American citizens. More than 60,000 Iowans, including nearly 1 in 10 African Americans, are barred from voting in Iowa due to a prior felony conviction. People of faith, centered in Judeo-Christian values, advocate for a comprehensive perspective on matters related to the criminal justice system and the many communities affected by this system. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, ELCA, Social Statement on Criminal Justice, The Church and Criminal Justice, Hearing the Cries, emphasizes that, quote, "criminal justice mindsets need to be transformed, that challenges the logic equating more punitive measures with more just ones. Individuals must be held accountable, but every person in the criminal justice system deserves to be seen and treated as a member of human communities created in the image of God and worthy of appropriate and compassionate response," unquote. As we move into the fall election season and into the new year, ask the candidates for the Iowa House and Senate if they intend to support a constitutional amendment to restore voting rights to ex-felons, and advocate with them and members of the Iowa legislature in 2021 to get this done early in the next legislative session. Permitting ex-felons to vote is an important step toward reintegrating people who have paid their debt back to society. A permanent solution is needed now. That was written by the Reverend Neil P. Harrison, senior pastor of First Lutheran Church of Maquoketa and a former Iowa legislator. There are two letters to the editor. The first from Helen Thielen, who lives on Pennsylvania Avenue, and it's titled "An Alphabet for First Responders." A is for available, which you always are. B is for belief in what you do, and C means that you care. D is for dedication. The amount you have is huge. E stands for ever ready for whatever comes your way. F stands for fearless and the faith everyone has in you. G says great job for all you do. I is for immediate response, no delay, and J is for judicious. Oh yes, you are in making wise decisions and giving strength in what you choose to say. K means kindness. Then there is LMNOP, which comes out as lots more notes of pride. QRST has you quiet, reserved, steadfast, and trusted, not only by patients, but by the people you work with side by side. That leaves UVWXYZ and ZZZ. You are understanding, vital, and wonderful. X, let's see, the 24th letter of my alphabet, also stands for 10, of which you all rate. And Y stands for you, too, for all of you. Which brings us to Z for zest or zealous, which describes all of you eager, enthusiastic people. Thank you, first responders. God bless you. That was written by Helen Thielen, who lives on Pennsylvania Avenue. And her second letter is from Doug Cheever, who lives on Kelly Lane. The letter is titled Dubuque Community Working Well Together. I'm proud to live in Dubuque. In a time of uncertainty that is changing our lifestyles and habits, we are blessed with staff at city and county agencies, nonprofits, schools, and businesses who mostly are working together to keep the community and their employees healthy and safe and to fill gaps as they appear. We also are blessed by the far-sighted persistence of leaders who early on put the resources in place for widespread COVID testing despite slow and hesitant state support. Thank you. That was written by Doug Cheever, who lives on Kelly Lane. At the top of the opinion page is a cartoon that shows a classroom with a large blackboard with back to school written on it. And there's a row of the alphabet across the top of the room, A, B, C. And there's a teacher wearing a mask holding up a notebook paper that has a title on it, What I Did This Summer. The teacher and the student are looking at each other, both wearing masks, and the teacher says, as she holds the paper in front of the student, it's blank, and the student says, yep. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Monday, July 27th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituary. And on the list of those mentioned with funeral service information, Ronald G. Buxton Sr., Dubuque, services 11 a.m. Tuesday, July 28th, the Bear Funeral Home on Main Street, visitation 3 to 7 p.m. today at the funeral home. Phyllis W. Cooper of Dubuque, services 11 a.m. today, the Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Westview Funeral Home and Crematory on Kennedy Road, visitation 10 a.m. until time of services at the funeral home. Alan A. Dreyer, Otter Creek, Iowa, celebration of life, 11:30 a.m. Tuesday, July 28, the Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa, visitation 10 to 11:15 a.m. Tuesday at the funeral home. Paul M. Dunn, Cuba City, Wisconsin, services noon Tuesday, July 28, the Houdenshield Funeral Home and Cremation Services, Cuba City, the visitation 10:30 a.m. Tuesday until the time of services at the funeral home. Jack Elric, East Dubuque, Illinois, graveside service 2 p.m. today, Shapville Zion Presbyterian Church Cemetery, Shapville, Illinois. Ray W. Feige, Cuba City, Wisconsin, Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m. Tuesday, July 28, St. Rose of Lima Church, Cuba City, visitation 9 to 10:45 a.m. Tuesday at the church. Trudy J. Hancock, Urbandale, Iowa, Mass of Christian Burial, 10 a.m. Tuesday, July 28, St. Pius X Catholic Church on 66th Street, Urbandale, visitation 4 to 7 p.m. today the Caldwell Parish Funeral Home on Hickman Road, Urbandale. Thomas E. Heath, Iowa City, formerly of Dubuque, Graveside Memorial Mass, 11 a.m., Wednesday, July 29, Calvary Cemetery, Brooklyn, Iowa. Daniel R. Hermson, Dyersville, Iowa, Mass of Christian Burial, 1038 today, the St. Francis Xavier Basilica, Dyersville. Visitation 9 to 10 a.m. today, Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville. Mary J. Hyde, Galena, Illinois, services 11 a.m. Wednesday, July 29, Furlong Funeral Chapel, Galena. Visitation 10:30 a.m. Wednesday until time of services at the chapel. Larry E. Mook, Fenimore, Wisconsin, services 11 a.m. today, Larson Family Funeral Home, Fenimore, with visitation 10 a.m. until time of services at the funeral home. Irvin Nyberg, West Union, Iowa, services 3 p.m. today, Burnham Wood Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, West Union, visitation 1 p.m. until time of services at the funeral home. William M. Schneider, Savannah, Illinois, celebration of life 1 to 3 p.m. Sunday, August 2nd, Law Jones Funeral Home, Mount Carroll, Illinois. Daniel F. Tepley, Jr., Dubuque, formerly of East Dubuque, Illinois, 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, July 28th, Miller Funeral Home, East Dubuque, visitation 4 to 7 p.m. today at the funeral home. And Michael J. Wolfacool. Michael J. Wolfacool. I'm going to spell that last name, W-L-F-E-K-U-H-L-E. Michael J. Wolfacool of Dubuque, Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, July 28, Church of the Resurrection on Asbury Road. Visitation 3 to 7 p.m. today, the Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road, after 9:30 a.m. Tuesday until time of services at the church. And now turning to our longer notices, David J., known as Rudy Harry, 64, of Dubuque, passed away Thursday, July 23rd at the University of Iowa Hospital. Funeral services 11 a.m. Wednesday, July 29th at Linwood Cemetery with Reverend Katrina Richardson officiating. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, July 28th at the Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road with a prayer service at 6:30 p.m. Family and friends may also gather at 10 a.m. Wednesday, July 29th at the funeral home until the procession leaves for the cemetery. Rudy was born in Dubuque on October 12, 1955, the son of Lloyd and Harriet Gert Harry. He graduated from Hempstead High School in 1973. Rudy had a great love of Harleys and took several trips out west and attended many swap meets. He could be found playing euchre or cribbage any time. If he wasn't giving some little one a ride of tot-tot to Boston, he enjoyed the outdoors, hunting and camping, and feeding his backyard wildlife visitors and his dogs, Bear and Autumn. He was always busy, but never too busy to stop and help a friend. He was preceded in death by his parents, a grandson, Joshua Stevens, infant siblings, Catherine and Dwayne Harry, along with Malcolm Grosheim, Carol and Joseph Reinert, Gary Harry, and spouse Connie Dement, and Lloyd Michael Harry. Pamela Ostrander, 67, of Dubuque, died Saturday, July 25th, at her home. Visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, July 28, at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service on Asbury Road. We ask you to acknowledge to observe the protocols for distancing and safety at this time. The funeral service for Pam will be 10 a.m. Wednesday, July 29, at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service. Barry will be at Asbury Cemetery. The service will be live streamed on Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home's Facebook page and will also be available to view later at the website for the funeral home. Pam was born August 13, 1952 in Dubuque, the daughter of Warren and Betty Calloway Schmidt. On October 25, 1969, she married Lee Tom Ostrander in Dubuque. She was a homemaker and enjoyed shopping, cooking, casinos, playing cards, especially poker. She especially cherished time with her children. Besides her parents, she was preceded in death by one brother, Warren Schmidt, and one sister, April Schmidt. Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service is in care of arrangements. A photo tribute can be viewed on and condolences sent to the family by visiting the website of the Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service, and that's for Pam Ostrander. From Cascade, Keith J. McDermott, Keith L. 77, of Cascade, died on Saturday, July 25th, visitation 3 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, on July 28th, St. Michael's Catholic Church, Cascade. Mass of Christian burial, 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, July 29th, at the church. Burial with full military honors will be in Calvary Cemetery for Kenneth J. McDermott of Cascade. From Moline, Illinois, Loretta M. Rogers, 84, formerly of Galena, died on Friday, July 24th, at Amber Ridge Memory Care in Moline. Graveside service, 11 a.m. Tuesday, July 28, at St. Michael Catholic Cemetery and Burial will follow. Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena is assisting the family of Loretta M. Rogers. Marcella E. Opfer, O-P-F-E-R, Marcella E. Opfer, Waucon, Iowa. She was known as Marcy. She died at the age of 101 on Saturday, July 25th. Graveside services will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, July 28th at Zalmona Cemetery in rural Waucon. The Martin Funeral Home is assisting the family of Marcella E. Opfer. On the sports page, we have a swimming story. Dubuque swimming great passes away at 44. Trudy Henkels Hancock owned 7 school records when she graduated from Wallert in the mid-1990s. This is reported by Jim Leitner. The Dubuque swimming community lost one of its all-time great competitors and biggest supporters suddenly last week. Trudy Henkels Hancock, who owned 7 school records at Dubuque Wallert when she graduated in 1994, passed away Wednesday in Des Moines from sudden heart complications. She was 44. Her visitation will take place 4 to 7 p.m. today at Caldwell Parish Funeral Home, Urbandale, Iowa, and a Mass of Christian burial will be 10 a.m. Tuesday at St. Pius X Catholic Church in Urbandale. Trudy and I both swam the butterfly, and I'll always remember her as being a fierce competitor, said current Wallert coach Emily Snyder, a 1995 graduate of senior. But she was only like that on the blocks and in the water. Outside of the water, she would be one of the first one to give you a hug or give you words of encouragement. She was always so supportive and showed such great sportsmanship. When Snyder took over the Golden Eagles coaching reins a little more than 2 decades ago, Hancock still owned 4 school records. But Hancock didn't expect those records to last forever, and she actually rooted for girls to bump her from the record board. There were a couple of years there when Abby Montag was getting real close to breaking Trudy's butterfly record, and Trudy came to our circle at the state meet and talked to the team, Snyder said. She'd always say, "I want you to break the record. Records are made to be broken." That's just the kind of person she was. She always had that eagle spirit, and she always came back to Dubuque when one of the girls broke her record, and we had a little ceremony to celebrate it. Most of her records lasted a long time, and it meant a lot to the girls to break them, and it meant a lot to them that Trudy was so supportive of them breaking those records. During her high school career from 1990 to 1993, Hancock earned honorable mention All-American twice and All-State seven times while qualified for the state meet all four seasons. She won state titles in the 100 butterfly, the 200 medley relay, and finished second in the 100 butterfly twice. Hancock finished on the podium, top six times, won seven regional championships, and took second at regionals five other times. She is enshrined in both the Iowa High School Swim Coaches Association Hall of Fame and the Waller Athletic Hall of Fame. Hancock was an original member of the Dubuque Area Swimming Hurricanes in the early 1990s and served as an athlete representative to the Dash Board of Directors. She was a two-time junior national qualifier. Trudy was so coachable and someone who was just fun, really fun to be around, said Bob Wren, who coached Hancock at Wallert and presented her with her State Hall of Fame plaque in 2016. Even when I had a chance to catch up with her later on, she was always so personable and so happy-go-lucky. A lot of really good swimmers have come out of Dubuque over the years, and I'd have to say she's definitely one of those all-time greats. Hancock continued her swimming career for two seasons at Northern Arizona University, where she won the 1995 Big Sky Conference title in the 200 butterfly, and for one season at Iowa State University. She remained active in the sport as a youth coach and most recently worked with the Dowling Catholic Riptide and DSMY Marlins swim teams. Her husband, Neil Hancock, and their two sons, Tom and Joe, are also heavily active in the sport. Accompanying the article is a picture of a smiling Trudy Hancock. In prep softball, Hawks aim for crown. West Delaware earns number two seed for Class 4A state tournament. This is reported by Tim O'Neill. The seventh and final week of an abbreviated Iowa high school softball season ends today with the quarterfinals of the Iowa State tournament. And he gives a capsule look at West Delaware's 4A bracket. And so I'm not going to repeat all those statistics. I read the conclusion of his article with an outlook section. West Delaware rolls into the state tournament with a 15-game winning streak and aspirations of winning a state championship. West Delaware is making its second consecutive appearance at the tournament and is 15th overall. Winterset is in the tournament for the 10th time and for the first since 2017. The Hawks and Huskies do not have any common opponents during the regular season. Winterset, which has won five consecutive games, played a pair of 4A tournament teams during the regular season, but lost decisions to Carlisle, 7-4, and Dallas Center Grimes, 9-4. West Delaware enters the tournament hitting .378 as a team with 79 extra base hits and 189 RBIs. The Hawks are 99-100 on stolen base attempts as a team and boast a .963 team fielding percentage. The Huskies are hitting .349 as a team with 37 doubles, 3 triples, and 20 home runs. 10 players have combined to drive in 130 runs. The Sports Complex concession stand is certified by the Iowa Department of Public Health and will have select items available for purchase. Spectators are encouraged to wear face masks during while entering, leaving, and moving around the complex. Fans will be expected to comply with social distancing measures, and bleacher seating will be limited, though spectators may bring their own lawn chairs. The article is accompanied by an action picture of Heather Himes sliding safely into home to score a run during West Delaware's victory over Independence earlier this season. As it mentioned, the Hawks open the state tournament play today in Fort Dodge against Winterset. On the Tri-State page, tractor ride very peaceful in southwest Wisconsin. This is reported by Eric Hogstrom from Lancaster, Wisconsin. Dale Lenth chugged along Grant County back roads in his 72-year-old tractor Sunday, his faithful companion Sammy sitting in a little box at Lent's side. The pair's tractor was among the first 73 participating tractors to reach Vesperman Farms near Lancaster during the 11th annual Southwest Wisconsin Tractor Ride. "I like being out in the open, driving slow for sightseeing purposes," says Lenth at of Castalia, Iowa. "It's very peaceful for me." Lenth's dog Sammy is usually along for the ride during the annual event. This year, an approximately 50-mile round-trip excursion that began in Fenimore and continued along back roads to Vesperman Farms and back again. "He comes along all the time," said Lenth, who has participated in the ride for about 10 years. "He likes to ride motorcycles, too. He rode out to Sturgis, South Dakota, with me 3 years ago." Sunday's event was both revised and revived. "We had originally canceled it, and then Vesperman Farm said they would host us," said organizer John Collins of Fenimore. Collins said the turnout for Sunday's event was slightly smaller than usual. "We've had over 150 tractors participate in previous rides, but with the virus and us canceling it and then bringing it back, it made a difference," Collins said. He helped launch the original tractor ride 11 years ago. "For farmers like me, the tractors bring back good memories," said Collins, who drove an International Harvester 460 during Sunday's ride. "Farmers love it. They like to get on a tractor and blow a lot of black smoke." Participants passed a couple of long-term care facilities along the route, then arrived at Vesperman Farms for lunch, parking their tractors in lines for display. "The fun of the ride is the thrill of it, seeing all of the tractors," said organizer Shirley Stelflug of the town of Preston. Stelflug helped provide traffic control during the event. Some participating tractors towed wagons with friends and family members on board. "This brings families together," Stelflug said. "It's a family fun event." Lenth relaxed with Sammy during Sunday's lunch and before heading back on the return leg of the ride. "I'm off the farm. I'm a retired truck driver," he said, "but I love older tractors. I've had many." The article is accompanied by a picture of Dale Lenth of Castalia as his dog Sammy is riding along beside him, and his tractor has what looks like an awning or a cover to shield him from the sun. And there is an aerial photo of the tractors coming down a farm road on Sunday. Also on the same tri-state page, Piasta Council mulls ordinance for ATVs, eyes new lift station. This is reported by Annie Mayo. Piasta City Council members discussed at a work session Thursday an ordinance that would allow all terrain and utility vehicles on city roads, but council members said they needed more time to review a recent survey before making a decision. The council is set to take up the matter Tuesday. "The concern that I still have is the safety, and the other thing I have a concern about is this being pushed by a group of people that are out of town that could potentially be a nuisance here," said City Council member John Kraft. "I still don't know which way I am leaning." At a recent Piasta City Council meeting, ATV and UTV enthusiasts from Epworth and other nearby cities spoke about hoping to see an ordinance passed allowing them to ride in Piasta and stop at local businesses like Dairy Queen. The City Council released a survey on its website asking residents if they are favorable, unfavorable, or unsure of allowing ATVs and UTVs on city streets, in order to see how many Piasta residents are in favor of permitting the vehicles along city streets. Kraft said that so far he has reached out to about 150 residents and the opinions have been split. "He needs more time to talk to residents before deciding," he said. "I would like to see what the actual residents of the community say," Kraft said. The proposed ordinance would not allow ATVs or UTVs on city streets until after 6 p.m. on weekdays to limit the rush hour traffic. It also would expire a year from the date it is published unless City Council renews it. That is just if something terrible should happen, I want them to have the chance to renew it, said City Administrator Whitney Bethke. City Council members also reviewed a study completed by Veenstra and Kim Incorporated, which assessed the city's U.S. 20 and main lift stations. Both were constructed more than a decade ago. The study found that the lift station location on the east side of Piazza near U.S. 20 is already operating over capacity and needs to be replaced, Bethke said. The highway lift station is essentially living on borrowed time, she said. In a perfect world, I would like to bid for the lift station project in the winter. The U.S. 20 lift station will cost about $2.5 million to replace the station and its piping, Bethke said. The second lift station, located on the west side of the city, will remain intact until the city begins work to repair Cap Drive. That project is projected to begin in 2025. Now the council will probably hold further discussion at the next two meetings to determine if and when they want to move forward with the east side sewer, she said. It is my recommendation that we start sooner rather than later. Bethke said if the project is approved, residents might not see a spike in property taxes because the city will pay off old debt by the time it takes on the new project. We have four loans we are paying off now, so we're trying to work it so we pay off the old debt and then start paying on the new debt, she said. The article is accompanied by a block indicating meeting and survey information. It says the Piazza City Council meeting will be held starting at 6 p.m. Tuesday in the banquet room at the community center. Piazza City residents can take the ATV and UTV survey at the website for SurveyMonkey, surveymonkey.com, and it has an awful lot of following letters to direct you to that, but I think that on SurveyMonkey, if you were to type in the search for the Piazza Council survey meeting, you will find the way to that. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for this Monday, July 27. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
This is Jim Ralston, and I'm with IRIS, Short Take from the Iowa Curiosities. Farmers and their toys, Dyersville, Iowa. The wisdom on bumper stickers is true, and those with the most toys truly do win. Then the National Farm Toy Museum in Dyersville is a winner many times over, with two floors of more than 30,000 farm toys and exhibits, ranging from row after row of common tractors to combines, harvesters, and haulers, all the way down the extensive agricultural machinery lineup to an anhydrous ammonia tanker. The museum is a shrine and miniature to the heavy equipment Iowa farmers fuss over, endlessly fix, periodically live in during planting or harvesting, and tirelessly operate to bring home the grain or the beans that bring home the bacon. And don't let the word toy fool you. The only thing toy-like about these farm toys is that they are built to 1/16th or 1/32nd score. Scale, and don't have internal combustion engines. This is Iowa, after all. Farm machines aren't child's play, even when they're toys. Most of the toys are stunningly accurate, not to mention beautiful. Replicas of tractors or combines with particular makers like John Deere and Case, from particular years, with details accurate down to the windshield wipers. Children play with these toys not only to have fun, they got a vocational education and heavy equipment. Highlights of the museum include an exhibit explaining the notion of scale that features a full-size replica of a John Deere tractor accompanied by a row of successfully smaller scale models, from 1/2 scale all the way down to a realistically looking tractor you can carry in your pocket. Upstairs, look for more tractors and harvesters, enclosed in glass cases, more perhaps than you've ever hoped to see. And though the word toy does technically appear in this museum's name, don't expect much playing around. Tractors, trucks, trailers, and combines, even at 1/32nd or 1/64 scale, are way too wrapped up in Iowa's blood, sweat, and sorrow to be simple objects of play. Don't be surprised if you see some old-timer kicking the tires of a tiny Case combine, wondering how it would hold up harvesting more than 2,000 acres. Or some young, unquietly cussing pocket-sized John Deere because it won't turn over. The National Farm Toy Museum is at the intersection of US 20 and Iowa Highway 136 in Dyersville. Open daily from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., the museum also hosts a number of special events. Exhibits throughout the year, the largest of which is the granddaddy of all farm toy shows, held the first full weekend in November. For more information, call 563-875-2727 or visit www.nationalfarmtoymuseum.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.